Good morning, Pitt fans. It's Saturday, June 11th, and this is your third in a series of weekend podcasts on Saturday morning. This is Reed Koberger, and I'm doing this from the WRHK studios on my second floor of my house in beautiful Columbia, Maryland, where no architecture is older than 1970. First, I would like to thank you guys for the kind words you wrote in response to the three-part recruiting series I just did this last week. It was a lot of fun to research that, and to be honest, I had a lot of questions as I wrote it. And the more I delved into what kind of things happened and what kind of recruiting we had and how Pitt does their recruiting, which I touched on a little bit. I don't think Pitt's a whole lot different than any of the other colleges that do FBS recruiting. It's a big business, and it's a high-pressure game, and it's a thing that if you want to be good in football, you're going to have to succeed at recruiting. We know that. We saw that happen with over the last 10 years with Dave Wannstedt's players, and, you know, he got 9, 10, and 8 wins in 3 years, which is the best 3 year sequence we've had since the early 1980s, when we had Dan Marino and Jackie Sherrill and those guys back then, all those great ball players. And today I'm going to talk about that team, those 1980s teams and the football players on them. I'm going to read an article from Sports Illustrated, and it is a little bit of a depressing article because it deals with a tragedy that happened to the Pitt football team, one of our players, back in 1983. And us old-timers will remember, he's a linebacker, Todd Becker. And Todd Becker was a Pitt football player who was on special teams. He was a young guy. And he made just a horrible, tragic mistake, and was off the field, and it was at a party, and he ended up killing himself, not on purpose. It wasn't suicide. Now, that subject matter might sound kind of crappy for a Saturday afternoon, but it really shows to me the flavor of what Pitt football was like back then, and what can happen when things go awry. And one of the reasons I even found this article in the first place is because, based on that three-part recruiting series I did, that writing that left me with a lot of questions about just exactly what state is the Pitt football program in. And I have to tell you that after I've done my research, I'm doing a big article. Monday's going to have a big article. I'm going to have to probably split that up into two pieces also. Because it's just kind of fascinating to me to see the progression that's happened in the last decade of the University of Pittsburgh's football program. Now, we all know on the surface, you know, and in the article, I have to tell you, I talk about the player arrests as a baseline. The gist of the article is very positive. And to counterbalance that, I think, a little bit, I started looking at other things, history of Pitt football, and I came across this article. Now, I don't want to be really heavy-handed with this, because there's a lot of positive stuff in the article too that comes from the love teammates have for each other and the way the University of Pittsburgh really came together and the city came together to get through this tragedy that befell Todd Becker. So I'm going to start reading this. It's from a Sports Illustrated article, and it's titled, "Any of Us Might Have Done It." It's by Rick Terlanger, senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And the intro is a quote from Aristotle: "The young are permanently in a state resembling intoxication, for youth is sweet, and they are growing." Stated November 21, 1983, and I'll put a link in the article too, so that you can read it on your own later on if you like. But it starts as this: "A lot of the revelers were still in their togas, but Todd Becker had taken his off and was back in street clothes. As he hung by his hands from a third-story window of Brackenridge Hall at the University of Pittsburgh, he seemed fearless. Yet it was fear that had driven him out the window in the first place. Certainly he was intoxicated. The coroner's report would later determine the alcohol level in Becker's blood to be about 0.15%, 50% more than the accepted medical definition of drunkenness while driving. It was December 15, 1982, and the Pitt football team, with a 9-2 record and ranked number 6 in the nation, was scheduled to leave for the Cotton Bowl the next day. Becker was a sophomore backup linebacker for the Panthers, a special teams demon who Coach Foz Fazio said always just leveled his man. The occasion was a toga party, the kind of bacchanalian hoedown that Aristotle himself must have witnessed occasionally, and which was immortalized for modern youth in the movie Animal House. Because it was the last day of fall finals, the affair had a letting off of steam air about it. "Just great friends and great times," recalled Pitt senior defensive tackle Bill Maz, who with his roommate, who was Becker's roommate, Dave Pozzoli, now a member of the Cleveland Browns, threw the bash in their sixth-floor Brackenridge suite. Dorm parties had been banned during finals, but the spirit of this one was in keeping with the campus mood. "The streets and bars around school were crowded with students out having a good time," said Christina Clinton, editor of the Pitt News, the student newspaper, which had already printed its last issue of the year. "I was out drinking, too." In all probability, nothing unusual would have happened at the party had dorm officials and campus police not arrived after midnight to check on the fire alarm that had gone off. "Someone's always pulling a fire alarm," said Bill Maz. But Becker was scared. He had been barred from all Pitt dormitories for 2 years for squirting a fire extinguisher in his freshman dorm, and he knew well that he'd be in trouble if school officials saw him now. He might be suspended from the team, which would mean that his dream of playing in the Cotton Bowl would go unrealized. "I told him, 'Listen, just go in my room, close the door, and wait for everyone to come back,'" said Maz. But Becker, who had sneaked into the dorm through a third-floor window in a friend's room, went back down to the third floor to try to get out the same way he'd come in. He banged on the friend's door and got no answer. A woman student across the hall, heard the racket and, because she knew Becker, let him into her room. Becker went to the window, opened it, and started to climb out. Both the woman and a male friend of Becker's, not a student, who had accompanied him to the party, yelled that it was too far to jump. The window across the hall through which Becker had entered the dorm was almost at ground level, but because of Pittsburgh's hilly terrain, this one was 35 feet above a cement walkway. Becker's friend grabbed his wrist, but Becker, who was now hanging by both hands, looked down and said he could make it. He pushed away from the window and dropped into the night. "Todd was a happy-go-lucky kid," said Maz, who insists, like others at the party, that Becker didn't seem drunk. "And really, any of us might have done it. It's something that we would laugh about later." "He had no fear," said Fazio. "I'm sure he thought, 'This is easy for me. I can do this. I'll jump down and I'll be at practice tomorrow.'" He might have been, too, had he landed on his feet. Instead, he hit a protruding air conditioner, spun in midair, and landed on the pavement headfirst, suffering fatal brain damage. He died a short time later in the trauma center of Presbyterian University Hospital. Fazio received a call at his home and rushed to the hospital, where he found a number of Panther football players and other students praying. He stared at Becker's body. "He had on one of his old game jerseys," said Fazio. "He had those big arms and he just looked so alive." From the hospital, Fazio went to his office where he met athletic director Ed Bozick, a former Air Force colonel. Bozick was stunned. "I've sent men into combat and some of those men haven't come back," he says. "But this death was so unnecessary. Perhaps this incident should be forgotten, written off as an aberration, an inexplicable college tragedy. But in its poignance, it points to something deeper, something in youth itself. It also points to something in the fabric of big-time college football and to something in the atmosphere at Pitt, a school that boasts 93 years of proud football tradition, 9 national championships, and 57 All-Americans at the time. Pitt is little different from the Oklahomas and the Michigans, except that it resides in an NFL city where football is seen almost as a birthright of its citizens, and this matters. So much is expected of Pitt athletes, says information director Jim O'Brien, who was born and raised in Pittsburgh and graduated from the school in 1964. They aren't compared with other college players. They're compared with the Steelers. When a Pitt team plays a game, it's not just representing the university. It is representing the city of Pittsburgh, the city of champions. Everything at this school is done under magnifying glass. Fazio shakes his head as he ponders Becker's fatal plunge. There were so many events building up. So many things were bringing him closer to that window. It had a lot to do with pressure. Much of that was on Fazio himself. As a first-year coach, Fazio, a former Pitt linebacker, class of 60, from nearby Coriopolis, was taking over a program that was so successful, the Panthers had more wins, 71 including bowls, over the last 7 years, than any other Division I school, that he seemed more of a cosmetic addition than a true leader. Pitt was most everyone's 1982 preseason number one pick. It seemed that all the big-hearted, fun-loving, local boy makes good Fazio had to do was roll out the ball, and the talent brought in by former coach Jackie Sherrill could whip the Steelers themselves. Indeed, three Pitt players, Dan Marino, Tim Lewis, and Jimbo Covert, were selected in the first round of this year's NFL draft, and six others were picked in the later rounds. Just winning wasn't enough, however. People wanted routes, annihilations. "We were 7-0 and getting ripped," says Fazio. "We beat Syracuse 14-0, and everyone said, what's wrong with the offense?" Unlike most major football schools, Pitt is situated in a major media market, and thus the team comes under the scrutiny of a sophisticated press. From the start, Fazio's players felt the heat from the media. "Even training camp was like the Democratic National Convention," says Fazio. "Maybe I should have kept it looser, I don't know. But we did not play loose. The press was so hostile that I always felt it was against us. It was us against the world," recalls Joyce Ashenbrenner, the football sports information director at Pitt last year, and now the SID at UNLV. "I remember a column in a newspaper that referred to the well-oiled Pitt publicity machine. I cut that out and put it in my wallet because it was so funny. People had no idea what we were going through. We were just hanging on for dear life." In the beginning, Fazio stayed up at his observation tower, a la Bear Bryant, and surveyed his team darkly. Shortly before the start of preseason practice, he learned that his wife, Norma, had cancer. "They operated on her on pitcher day," said Fazio. "I remember that. Norma was in and out of Presbyterian Hospital for more than a month, and suddenly her husband's world became very small." "We live three blocks from this office," said Fazio, leaning over his desk at the stadium and pointing out the window. This is Pitt Stadium at the time. "And the hospital's right across the street. To be honest, I was so busy with football and getting our two kids off to school and going over there that I don't know what I thought." Fazio does know that the pressure on his players was unbelievable. Money brought on part of this. As is the case at most big schools, Pitt's football program more or less subsidizes the university's entire athletic department. The team had better generate a given amount of TV and bowl game income by season's end, or all hell can break loose. "What it means is that this is big business, said Bozic, "and that some 18 or 19-year-old is going to drop it or catch a pass that will cost or make you $1 million. Also, for many of the players, getting drafted by the pros was a constant concern. Becker had plenty of time to make his mark, but he wasn't starting, and that frightened him. The ghosts of Panther stars measured on him daily. Just inside the Pitt locker room door, Tony Dorsett's Heisman Trophy glints dully. The retired lockers of Dorsett, Marino, and Hugh Green, sealed over with plexiglass and marked with metal plaques, remain in place and speak silently, almost mystically, of greatness. Becker's deepest fear focused on a bottling plant near his hometown in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. He always said he'd end up back at the plant if he didn't make it into the pros, said teammate Chris Warman the day after Becker died. Then there were the fans. In Pittsburgh, they're tough and knowledgeable and spoiled by years of Steeler and Panther success. They think nothing of booing a player who's not a pro, not even a man yet, said John Pelosi, the center on Pitt's 1976 national championship team, and now a local financial consultant. The fans got on All-American quarterback Marino so mercilessly for having a subpar senior season that even Joe Paterno, coach of arch-rival Penn State, was moved to tell a Pittsburgh reporter in early December, "I think we have to get rid of that junk," meaning the fans booing so badly. Pitt had no athletic dorms and few special rules for athletes. Nothing insulates the players from the commotion around them. The campus consists of a number of high rises near Forbes Avenue at the eastern end of the city, just below the Hill District's ghetto. Bars, night spots, and liquor stores dot the area, and drinking is almost de rigueur for the students. In fact, there's a bar less than 100 yards from where Becker fell. The urban setting is both the beauty and the blemish of the school. It takes a special kind of kid to go to Pitt, says Ashenbrenner. It's not Happy Valley U with a quaint little campus, but it's always exciting. Just stand on Forbes Avenue for 45 minutes and see how many fire trucks and police cars go by. O'Brien recalls that when he was a freshman at Pitt in 1960, a Panther football player was stabbed in a city bar. O'Brien also remembers celebrating his 21st birthday, the first day he could legally drink, in a tavern where he and his pals had already been drinking for 2 years. You're not in an incubator at Pitt, says O'Brien. This school prepares you for the real world. Last year, perhaps, Pitt football players could have used a buffer zone, an area where they could have rested and been debriefed before leaving their world up at Pitt Stadium and entering the one below. By late November, dissension had begun to plague the team. Pitt had lost two of its last three games, and everyone was dumbfounded. Lewis, who's now with the Green Bay Packers, publicly blasted some of his teammates for not giving their all. Eventually, Associate Athletic Director Dean Billick called a press conference, just so Lewis and others could explain their statements. But the biggest problem was so natural, it defied resolution. The players felt rootless. This was always the question. Whose team is it, Cheryl's or now Fazio's, said Bozick. And they were unable to rally as a group. They were simply too young. Senior wide receiver Dwight Collins claims that pressure isn't a problem for him now that he's married. The commitment, said Collins, gives him discipline and order. But he quickly adds, other guys might not have had that. Order is not a natural gift of youth, particularly not of young football players. In this context, order doesn't mean the drive to work or the willingness to make sacrifices for a larger goal. Football players have to have that to an extreme. What is meant is the order one obtains from having priorities set, from being at peace, from knowing the difference between a violent game and a society that frowns on violence, from knowing, as Bozick says, when to turn it on and when to turn it off. Becker was still learning when to turn it on and off. The Panthers' 1982 media guy said the 6'2", 214-pounder's favorite pastime was lifting weights. He was such a good football player, said his father, Al, a trucker. He was a killer. But the same aggressiveness that delighted every coach Becker had ever had was a problem off the field. On his calf, Becker bore a tattoo of a grinning Sylvester the Cat hanging Tweety Bird by the neck of a piece of rope. It was a violent tattoo, and Becker sometimes seemed violent himself. He sort of scared you at first, because you couldn't tell what he was going to do, said John Cato, a junior defensive back who was a friend of Becker's from Massachusetts. But he wasn't a brute. He cared for the people around him, and he loved kids. But he was kind of wild. I remember my dad saying to me, you can only cross that white line so many times. And I think, Todd's crossing it again. What's going to happen to him? Something's going to happen to him. Bozick has often thought about the dilemma of youthful exuberance in both sports and war. Football training is very much analogous to military training, he said. In both cases, young men are trained to do things they instinctively would not do. This has to condition your psyche. But the question is, can you convert that training and use its positive elements into normal life? In the military, we have what we call war lovers, the ones who can't turn it off. But everyone is constantly trained to act like gentlemen when not in a battle situation. Basically, I believe in Aristotelian philosophy of striking a median, a balance. Any characteristic taken to an extreme becomes a vice. And after all, getting into trouble, doing stupid things, that's not really the province of football players. It's traditional for young players, for young people to get in trouble. But football players tend to be wilder than other students. At Pitt, this is particularly true of defensive players. In a primitive way, Panther defenders have always seemed to represent those Pittsburghers who would love to just once strike out from their dreary jobs or joblessness and tear into the big guys. People here in Pittsburgh love to see teams beat the hell out of teams from prettier places, says O'Brien. Last February, Pozzoli, who played defensive back for the Panthers, and Dennis Atia, a linebacker, got into a fight with 8 Pittsburgh police officers outside a bar. Pozzoli and Atia were beaten so badly that, according to Ashenbrenner, who took photos at the police station, Pozzoli's underwear was covered with blood, and both players were cut and bleeding from dog bites. The police, though, took a beating also. 7 of the 8 were injured. One has testified that he started to go for his gun because Atia threatened to kill me with my own nightstick, and that Atia seemed to be highly intoxicated. Many questions remain unanswered about the brouhaha, but a number of people think the players were the victims of police overreaction. Fazio was a defensive coordinator at Pitt before getting the head position, and he thinks the Panthers' current defensive zeal started when Green enrolled in 1977. 3-time All-American defensive end, now at Tampa Bay, Green brought a spirited abandon not only to games but to practices as well. "Hugh's enthusiasm spread," said Fazio. "At times, practices were hilarious. At other times, they were like wars. A couple of Pitt players who hunted during off days began to give bear screams during practice. At night, they lean out their dorm windows and scream, 'Argh!' into the city. And then they did it in the games. The Panther defense ranked among the top 5 in the country each of the last 4 seasons, terrified opponents. Todd picked it up," said Fazio. "He fit in, he loved to hit." Through the years, several Pitt gridiron stars, including Paul Martha, Mike Ditka, and Dorsett, have gotten into ugly scrapes either with the law or with university officials. Fazio himself says he's lucky to have made it out of high school without ending up dead or incarcerated. Pelosi got in a street fight while at Pitt and was arrested along with 2 teammates. After a 4.5-day trial, the 3 were cleared of all charges. Today, Pelosi is a successful businessman. The club he's sitting in Oxford Center in downtown Pittsburgh is part of the $100 million building his firm financed. Pelosi looks back onto the incident as an unfortunate but perhaps necessary stepping stone to adulthood. "Look around," he says, gesturing at the sedate luncheon crowd. "These are some of the city's biggest business people, and I bet not one of them isn't embarrassed by something he did in the past." The problem, of course, is surviving the growth process. People expect Pitt football players to be big shots, not only on a field, but off of it, says Clinton of the Pitt News. They have to have the biggest partiers. They have to have the biggest drinkers, the wildest ones. And they're only human. Moz, an All-American and certain first-round NFL pick next spring, started to realize this. "You'd be doing great in games for a couple weeks. Then all of a sudden, you'll take a hard one to the chin and you stop and think, 'Hey, I'm not immoral.' That such news should have to be learned is almost ludicrous. But the myopia of youth may well be a vital characteristic, a trait that helps keep our species on its toes, that keeps us striving against great and even foolish odds. If nothing else, it's one reason the Army drafts 18-year-olds and not contented middle-aged executives." In October 1982, David Packer, a freshman wide receiver at the University of Rhode Island, apparently fell from a 4th-floor window of a campus dorm and suffered such severe brain trauma that he was not expected to live. But he did. However, and though he'll probably never play football again, he may be able to re-enroll at Rhode Island next fall. No one, not even Packer, who has a 20-minute memory gap leading up to the accident, knows exactly what happened. He was probably just carrying out a crazy prank. Last Friday at 4:15 a.m., Andrew Radcliffe, the starting goalkeeper for the Hofstra University soccer team, was critically injured when he fell 5 stories from a dormitory window. Radcliffe landed on his head and suffered multiple skull fractures as well as broken arms and legs and internal injuries. Radcliffe had been drinking beer when he and a friend went to the room to visit 2 female students. He was sitting on the window ledge, lost his balance, and fell. What disturbs Rod Crafts, Rhode Island's Dean of Student Life, is the way students invariably react to tragedies like Packer's and Radcliffe's. "It's one of my duties to counsel close friends of victims," said Crafts, "and a common thread is always there. College students do not see themselves as vulnerable. They often say, 'I thought death was for my grandparents, not for me.' But for Becker's parents, death is something that can happen to the young. 'I think about him every day, all the time,' says Al Becker. 'He was my dream. Now I can hardly watch football at all.'" In the beginning, the Beckers, who have 2 other sons, were excited about Todd going to Pitt. We were the proudest people in Fitchburg, says Al. Nobody around here ever goes to a big school. But like the parents of any heavily recruited athletes, they knew their child would face disappointment if things didn't work out. My wife was just mentioning that it could have had a large effect on Todd that he wasn't first team, that he could have been hurt inside, says Al. From 10th grade on, he never sat on the bench. His senior year at Fitchburg, he broke the school record for tackles and led the team in rushing. I drive a trailer truck, and I'm unfamiliar with college life. But did they have to ban him from the dorms for 2 years? He didn't do anything malicious. He was a tough kid, but he had feelings. Maybe they punished him because he wasn't a starter. I'm glad he went to Pitt, because he wanted to, said Todd's mother, Virginia. But now I'm just filled with what-ifs. One of those is, what if Todd had gone to UCLA, who had recruited him and wanted him to spend 2 years at a California junior college before joining the Bruins? But as Al says, my wife's never been out there. Besides, Al continues, his driving experience made it nothing for us to drive to Pittsburgh and see all of Todd's games. The Pitt team delayed its trip to the Cotton Bowl for a day to attend a memorial service on campus for Todd. Fazio, Bozic, part-time assistant coach Jim Maselli, and several players, including Maz, Peluzio, Pozzoli, and Cato, later flew from Dallas to Fitchburg for the funeral. In the game against SMU, the Panthers wore patches on their jerseys bearing Becker's number, 38. The school flew his parents to Dallas and promised their youngest son, Jason, now 14 and 170-pound linebacker at Fitchburg High, a scholarship to Pitt. Virginia is ambivalent about the offer. The athletic department was very good to us, but the school itself never sent us one line of condolence. It's almost as though my son wasn't even a student. I wonder if anybody is even thinking about him there. Fazio is, all the time. Indeed, Fazio has changed not only because of Becker's death, but also because of everything he and his team went through last season. He's come down out of the tower to get closer to his players, and he has tried to institute new codes of discipline. Players can no longer wear caps at the training table. They can't put their helmets on the ground during practice. They must wear coats and ties to both home and away games. Further, at the start of the year, Fazio hired 38-year-old Carmen Grossa, a former Green Beret who saw action in Vietnam, to serve as a combination tight end coach and low-key disciplinarian. Fazio knows there's a paradox in such measures. As he told the Pittsburgh Press last August, we don't want them to be the best behaved, best dressed, most clean shaven, and then be the worst football players. Fazio still exhorts his defensive players to be wild and reckless and fearless afield. He still laughs at their antics, and he screams at them when they mess up. Most of all, he just wants them to make it through this tough period in their lives, performing to their best, unscathed. Todd's death had a sobering effect, said Fazio. I learned that if you have to keep things in proper perspective, you're trying to mold these kids, but you also know you can't change their personalities. You hope that they learn to do things the right way, that they learn to walk away from the bad things. Fazio, who openly marvels that he, the son of immigrants, is now the football coach at this proud school, pauses. On his wall is a 2.5-foot by 3-foot photo of the 63 Panther team, which went 9-1, losing only to Navy. Fazio didn't play on that squad, and he didn't coach it. The pitcher is there because he likes what the team accomplished after its victories. Of the 61 players on the roster, 57 graduated and 34 went on to obtain advanced degrees to become doctors, dentists, engineers, lawyers, coaches, teachers, businessmen, successes. The boys grew up. Fazio thinks once more of Becker. He looks at his desktop. You can't go half speed in football or you'll get hurt. His voice then drifts off and he shakes his head. If only I'd been there that night. The imagination of a boy is healthy, wrote John Keats, who died of tuberculosis at 26, partly because he didn't believe the disease would kill him. And the mature imagination of man is healthy, but there is a space of life between, in which the soul is in a ferment, the character undecided, the way of life uncertain, the ambition thick-sighted. It is a pity Todd Becker didn't make it past that ferment of the soul into his adulthood. That's it. I reread that article 2 or 3 times before I read it to you guys. I can't help but think that this isn't something that happens once in a while. It happens all the time in college football. With students everywhere, not just athletes. But the student athletes have that extra pressure they have on them. They have those expectations of people that don't even know them. A regular student, you know, their friends might want them to do well. Their parents certainly want them to succeed. They want to succeed. The school wants them to succeed. But really, the faceless 40,000 people in a stadium, they don't care a damn about that other student. But they do care about the football players. And what they want the football players to do is play football and win. I think that we forget that sometimes. As I said, I'm writing an article for Monday that I think will serve to bring us back around to understanding what the real mission of the University of Pittsburgh is. And I think that is to not only provide a fine and good education for people, but to have them reach their potential in any way they can. And part of that is through athletics. If we bring a kid on to the campus, we promise him a four-year education. We promise we're going to take care of him. In essence, the university is loco parentis, which means they're the local parents by law of the students until that student's 21 years old. Pitt has a lot of responsibilities to those kids. And one of them is to try to make sure that they don't go off the rails. I'm not sure exactly how you do that. I think role modeling is one way. I think that you have upperclassmen that have not gotten in trouble and should show the younger people how to do things the correct way. I don't buy into the argument that you have to have thugs, or you have to have criminals, or you have to have people that are overly violent or have antisocial tendencies to win football games. That's a bunch of a load of crap. I think that you can have kids that live on the edge. I mean, we just heard that Pelosi and Maz and all those guys, things happen in football players. They go on, they get in trouble. But the thing is, which ones get in trouble and which ones get through it? That's why I don't think that, I mean, as hard as I am, I guess, on some people, I don't think that every kid that gets in trouble needs to be suspended or expelled. I think suspension is an excellent tool for not only disciplining the person that needs to have the discipline, but also it shows other people what can happen, what ramifications can happen. I was very, very proud of Pat Narduzzi when he suspended both Boyd and Blair. And I know that we on the Blather, we had a lot of conversations leading up to that. Because it was such a big time period, especially for Blair, you know, it was 3 months before we even found out he had been arrested. But there was a long time, because it happened on the off season in March, I think it was in May and June of 2015, that we really didn't know what Pat Narduzzi was going to do. And he didn't have the responsibility or the need to actually tell us what was going to happen. He was going to make his own decisions. And I was a firm advocate that we needed to suspend those kids at least for a game. Whatever it was going to be, you had to show some kind of concrete action to tell those players and other players, this is not acceptable, and there's going to be ramifications to the things that you do that are outside the rules and the regulations that you had abided by or were chosen. You chose to come to Pitt to abide by those rules and regulations. Now, 18 years old, everyone says, well, he's an 18-year-old. That's bullshit. 18 years old, excuse my language. An 18-year-old certainly knows rules and regulations. It doesn't matter what their parents were like. You sit down and you tell somebody this is what you have to do. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to do it. As a matter of fact, I think almost every one of us can say, well, rules and regulations, when I was 18, I didn't care about them. Well, that's okay. If you don't care about them, then you're going to have to accept the consequences of your own actions. It's the fans that I don't understand that give these kids a pass. Because you don't have to come down and kick everyone out of school. You don't have to do that. You don't have to stop their careers or their dreams. But you have to make sure that if they know they're not supposed to do something and they go out and purposely do it, then there's a problem. Now, you know my feelings about the Jabal Sheard thing. I don't want to even talk about that. I touch on that a little bit in the article. But in that article I'm writing, I do list some other things, and I list the problems we've had with some of the student-athletes, some of the football players. And a good example of, I think, handling things the right way was, if we remember when Dan Mason was with Jason Douglas, and Jason Douglas was off the field, and they were at drinking, I believe. Well, I know Jason Douglas was because he was arrested for intoxication and hit and run, if we remember that. Well, Dan Mason wasn't, actually, he hadn't been drinking, and he was in the passenger seat of the car. Well, Dave Wansnett did, I think he handled that perfectly. I didn't agree with a lot of other stuff he did, believe me, but I think he handled that perfectly. He expelled Jason Douglas and, well, suspended him, then gathered the facts. And doesn't matter what the court system does, by the way, in these cases. It absolutely doesn't matter. This is a thing between the university and a student. The civil and judicial system doesn't mean a damn thing. But he waited till all the facts were in. He made his decision to get rid of Jason Douglas, to expel him. Now, what he did with Dan Mason is he didn't suspend him from any games. But because he was not, didn't actually take part in anything, any of the crime. Now, Dan Mason had a real lack of judgment, and I think we all recognize that. That the simple explanation would have been, hey, Dan, you know, take over the wheel. But the head coach doesn't have an easy job at all, and it can't be all one way or can't be all the other. And yeah, I know you guys think that because of my military background, I think I'm some sort of a real hard ass when it comes to discipline, and I'm really not. I think that you have to make sure that you understand exactly what happened, exactly why it happened, and whether it's going to happen again. And then you have to, the hard thing about leadership and about being a head coach or a senior officer is that you have to look at these situations. You have to say, if I do this, what's going to be the effect on the rest of the people around this kid? You know, I mean, if I go light on him because I want him to play ball on Saturday, and I go and I suspend this other kid for 4 games because he's a third stringer. Well, we know that that's not right, but we see it happen all the time. And, I mean, you know, everyone has a mission in life. The school has a mission to educate. The football team has a mission to win games. And, you know, the military has a mission to do whatever they have to do. So do parents. Parents have a mission to raise their kids up, get them 21 out of the house alive and healthy, and have them make good decisions later on in their lives. Anyway, enough expounding on my part. I'm going to 37 minutes. It has been a pleasure. I think that this article is a good one because it not only shows what football was like for the University of Pittsburgh and the city back when we were really winning a lot of ball games. Now, something else to factor in with this article is that we didn't do so well after this happened. After this happened is when we started going downhill under Fazio. And I'm sure that this kind of thing has an impact on that. It'll be interesting. I'll look into that and see exactly what happened. But thanks so much for listening again, and I'll have a little bit more later on during the week, but I would ask you guys to wait for this Monday morning article that I'm doing, and it's a long one. Like I said, I might have to split it in two, but we're going to have a lot to talk about, and I'm so very happy when I did the research on this and I started writing, and I said, well, you know what, Pitt's in pretty good shape right now, and I really am glad for that. Anyway. See you later. Have a good weekend.